We've got a flurry of questions that came in towards the end of Rich's talk, so apparently you're the controversial one. Okay, let's start with your punchline. You said, headship and respect are not only the key to a peaceful marriage, they are erotic necessities. How does that play into the relationship before marriage, if that's the dynamic within marriage, preparing for that kind of dynamic? Before young man and young woman are married, even on that first stage that Michael referred to, that kind of interested but not exclusive, is that a dynamic there as well?
You're dealing with before marriage. Maybe take this one. The one thing I would say is that when a woman is considering a man as a future husband, that's the big question she needs to ask is, do I find myself respecting this man, admiring this man? Would I find it hard to follow this man, or do I want to follow this man? And if she doesn't, then it's a hard pass. So that's the key thing for her. And I would say that's like when and of course, you know, no doubt she needs some help in vetting a man and all that. But I would say that's the key kind of question she needs to ask herself is, do I see myself respecting this man and following this man and that not being a huge deal?
This is a question whether or not she should be attracted to someone who turned on by her at the beginning. Is that really what's being asked?
Right. How can you discern headship as a basis pre-marriage?
Yes.
Okay, so it was said that folk wisdom or traditional wisdom, I think this is something you mentioned, Michael, are among those things that have been washed away in the cultural tsunami. So what are some specific kinds of folk wisdom that we've lost and we need to recover? So let's first answer for young men and then for young women.
Anything that has to do with bodily presence is a big one. For example, eye contact. They have trouble with this. They've been hiring actors that help people learn how to keep eye contact and make people feel comfortable in boardrooms when they're doing negotiation. And it comes to this big problem that in police policing, they're having guys go out and interact with people, and then people critique how they do it. Because in policing, you're reading people, right? You're feeling intuitively what's going on as you approach a car. You get their body language. But when your whole life's been mediated through a screen, or a large portion of it has been mediated through a screen, you don't have empathy, right, little faces, whatever. It's us trying to add that to a screen-mediated existence, to communicate tone or whatever. So one area is just like how to stand as you can. I'll give you a humorous example. I was telling a guy that he should probably work on his eye contact. He was always like kind of shifty, not looking with people because he was insecure. And I said, hey, you can deal with eye contact. And I saw him like months later. Actually, I had a struggle. So I saw him months later, and man, he was like intense.
Even one generation ago, but especially two or three generations ago, that everything you think you know about male-female interaction is wrong. So start. Let's just start over, because probably everything you think you know is bad at the end. You said 1924. I think a lot of men are turning to the red pill sources, manosphere, that kind of thing. A lot of that's very godless and unhelpful. But I think the good stuff that can be found there is the stuff that a generation or two ago, like you go back far enough in history, just everybody kind of knew it. So I think there are people out there that are trying to recover some of these things, some of the godless people included in that. But I would just say, if you've got godly grandparents or older people in your church you can go talk to, I think that oftentimes there's a lot of wisdom there that we don't tap into the show.
See, the term toxic effeminacy has been mentioned as one of the problems with men in the household. So can we define our terms? What is effeminacy?
It's a godly element. Right.
Unpack that.
Right. So to be a woman, if you are in fact a woman, you should be feminine. It's great. Femininity is beautiful on women, it's repulsive on men. It's because it goes the same. So effeminacy is where a man is taking on the posture, mannerisms, and goals of a woman. So a feminine man is a woman without a womb, right? So that's what it means to be effeminate. So you have Malfoy or Cinquecce, so you have actual homosexuality, but you have the culture that comes before them, which is throwing off masculine duties and throwing off masculine characteristics, delaying maturity, not being responsible, all those sort of things. I mean, big part of being a man is taking responsibility for others, right? Because you're a federal head, you're over a whole household, and as men grow as leaders, they become heads of multiple households, whether in the church or as a business leader, your community, etc. So effeminacy is taking something beautiful and twisting it because it goes against your nature. So again, it's like a dog in the animal, right? I don't have a feminine side unless you mean Emily. She's my feminine side, just like a dog doesn't have a feline side.
Well put. Yeah, I would agree with all that. I would just add a couple things in the traditional discussions of effeminacy, like the Christian ethicists, going back to St. Aquinas or whatever, taking up this issue. One thing that's been pointed out is that effeminacy is a lack of discipline. It's being obsessed with your own comfort and luxury. It's a lack of self-control. It can be manifested in spinelessness, cowardice, weakness, which I think men have an obligation to strengthen themselves. It's amazing when you start to look at how many commands there are in the Bible for people are told to make themselves strong. I mean, obviously, Paul talks about weakness in 2 Corinthians, and so, the kind of weakness that we have before God is entirely appropriate. But time and time again, God commands his people to be strong. And so the effeminate man is the man who has not done that. So there's that. I would also say there's certain little slogans or ways of doing things that kind of reinforce effeminacy in men. I'll give you one slogan, and often with these slogans, like, there's a little grain of truth to it, and that's why it gets traction. But then when you actually look at how it's used, it's a real problem. Like, here's one: happy wife, happy life. Okay. Now, obviously, Paul says again in 1 Corinthians 7, spouses should seek to please one another. So seeking to please your spouse is a good thing. But I've seen this kind of slogan used a lot of times for husbands who think that basically to be a husband means I am a simp, if I can use that word. That's what the kids would say today. A man who is overly concerned with pleasing his wife all the time. So he constantly defers. It's whatever you want, dear, whatever you say, honey. Well, she comes to resent that. That doesn't actually please her, because that's not giving her what she needs from you as a man. And I would say that's a form of effeminacy. Servant leadership is the same kind of way. Servant leadership is a beautiful and brilliant and biblical concept that Jesus leads, and one of the ways he manifests his leadership is through servants, through sacrifice. But again, this can get twisted in a certain kind of way where it becomes doing whatever the other person wants you to do. And so if you're a servant leader, the leadership part gets lost, and well, now I'm just your servant. So now I'm no longer the head of the family, I'm sort of the family butler, and I just take orders from everybody else. well, that leads to chaos. Because actually what you find is that good leadership in any institution, any organization, whether you're talking about a nation or a company or a ship or a football team or a household, good leadership, wise, confident leadership is itself a gift in the form of service. So I think that's really, really important to maintain. And the effeminate man is really embarrassed by his own manhood and embarrassed to assert himself. Because it feels like, oh, if I assert myself, then I'm going to be tyrannical. But see, the thing about assertive leadership model is that it kind of allows the woman to always play a trump card, you know, because she can say anytime he is going, you know, anytime he says, we need to go this direction, honey, and she wanted to go that direction, she can say, well, you're not really loving me like Jesus would. Because Jesus would give me what I want, right? Because we know that's what Jesus always does, right? He gives us everything we want. No, he doesn't. He doesn't always give us what, you know, what we want. In John chapter 6, Jesus has just offended all these people, who are the multitudes that have come to him, and for some of them are just coming to be fed, and he starts to say really hard things, like, you've got to eat my flesh and drink my blood, and all the people leave, and then he looks at the disciples and says, are you guys going to go too? And there's the door, if you want to leave, because he is committed to a mission. He's committed to a mission, and it's not going to be dictated to him by what everybody, you think of the people around him, the people that he's bride, basically. His mission is not dictated by the bride. He has his mission, and the bride is supposed to go on board with that. So I think effeminacy plays itself out in missionless men, purposeless men, men who are waiting to take orders rather than take responsibility and say, this is the direction I'm going to go. It's the opposite of what Joshua does in chapter 24, when he says, as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. The effeminate man can't do that.
Okay, so we've got your quintessential masculine man. He goes to the gym regularly, he hunts, he's a good mechanic, can work on his own car. Does he have any effeminacy problems? Has he solved them by having those, you know, cultural artifacts?
I would say, based on what you told me, I still have no idea whether or not this guy's effeminate. Because masculinity is not primarily hunting skills or mechanic skills. It is your skills, but the world is so big. There's so many different things we could master. What if he's a great computer programmer? You know, I mean, so I would just say the description you've given does not tell me whether he's really mastering or not yet. I don't know a lot.
Here's another angle that think about weightlifting. So weightlifting can be incredibly effeminate if it's bodybuilding, right? Where it's like it goes not now. I'm talking about professional bodybuilders, the big bandy sort of thing, right? These guys, I have a lot of friends that run into that world, and they don't get hit on as much by chicks as they do by gay guys, right? Or that's maybe an Englishman routine, or hit on. And part of what way I see that feminine, or potential feminine, is that you're making yourself an object of beauty to be stared at, and the strength is to turn outward at production. Right, it's more of a demonstration of the body. Right? That's what you're. So it makes sense for a woman to display beauty in that way. It doesn't, to me, make sense for a man to do that. And that it doesn't surprise me that a lot of times that it leads to them having a lot of homosexual guys hit on. I think what's important is a man uses his skill to be productive. I think that's the idea of building up a household is so key. And you can do that with hunting skills, I guess. I have a friend that's a professional hunter. But like Rich says, you can take the menu, but you need a good coder. A lot of people don't need the world full of he-men, but we do need the world full of strong men. And that needs to, that's going to be contextual to your ability and providence and all that sort of stuff.
You might have a man who goes hunting all the time, and it's just because he's trying to get out of the house because he has no leadership. You know, he's not exercising leadership there, so it's chaotic. And why is nagging him constantly? So hunting is a way of just getting away from all of that. Well, that's a feminist. You know, or you have a man who goes out hunting because his husband provides for his family so they can survive in winter. There's different. So I think we have certain caricatures of masculinity that are problematic. And again, there's a great truth in them. I mean, I would say as a man, you want to be mission-oriented. You want to acquire as many skills as you can as a man, I would say. You want to be, you know, you talk about improving yourself. Think of life like a video game. You have to be constantly leveling up. Where What are the new skills I can add? What are the new ways that I can extend dominion for the good of others? But I think one thing that Michael hit on is exactly right, is that for a man, the strength is going to be functional. It's not going to be just to gaze at, but it's going to serve a purpose for the betterment of his household or the kingdom of God. I don't want to look at that. You're making yourself better so you can do more for the sake of others.
So you have a married couple, and they've got a pattern. He tends to be passive. She tends to be dominant. How do they get unstuck?
The good news, I would say, is that it only takes one to get unstuck or to at least sort of force certain issues. So I would tell a man in that case, don't sit down trying to negotiate something with your wife, because that still puts you in a position of sort of submissiveness. I would say start leading. Assert yourself. Be the man that you know you should be. And she may really push back hard against that at first, but one of the realities is, I talked about the woman as the weaker vessel. I think one thing that women do sort of intuitively with men is test men. In fact, I would say anybody who's in a position of leadership should expect tests from those they seek to lead. Congregations do this with pastors in sessions. Sometimes employees will do this with a boss. Players will do this with a coach. You will test your leadership to see what you make. And very often, a wife will sort of, I'm not saying this is sin, because I think it's kind of a defense mechanism that's built into the way things are. She could do this in a disrespectful way. It could be sin. It doesn't have to be. But where she might just push back to test his leadership and see if he really means it. So if every time he says, we're going to do, A, and she raises an objection and says, what about B, and he immediately caves in, well, intuitively she's thinking, wow, this guy's weak. And if he can't stand up to me, then how's he going to stand up to anybody else for me on my behalf? And so that kind of creates more anxiety. So
he also reacts strongly to that test. That's another demonstration of the weakness of the lack of self-control and reinforce her doubts.
So, I would say he ought to lead, he ought to assert himself, he ought to seek to be more decisive, and it may take a while for her to get on board, and it may be a lot of pushback for a while, but he needs to stick with it. I think what happens with a lot of men is they say, all right, I'm going to lead my family better, and then the first time there's any pushback, they just cave. And things are then actually worse than before. That's probably how they got stuck in the first place. So I would say that's what you have to do, is just become the man you know you should have been all along, and do those things. And that may make things seem like they're worse for a little bit. But I think things like this, one of my favorite books is The Right Stuff by Tom Wolfe. Tells the story of Chuck Yeager when he broke the sound barrier. And people didn't know it could be done. They really talk about a sound barrier because they get planes real close to Mach speed, and they would just kind of shake apart. People wonder, can you break the speed of sound? And Yeager, who had only finished high school, not a physicist or anything, he knew flying. New planes, and he just had this intuition that I think things shake really bad right up when you get to Mach 1, and then the other side is completely flat. Well, of course, it turned out he was exactly right. And so he got the Bell S1 and breaks the sound barrier. And I think a lot of times that's how leadership is. There's a lot of chaos right before the calm. There's a storm right before the calm. You just have to press through. But it can sometimes take the same kind of courage as a major to get up in that plane.
Okay, so we're running beyond time. We're probably going to get kicked out of here by All Saints here quickly. But so we're going to go into kind of a lightning round, try to do quicker questions, quicker answers. Do you have any basic rules of engagement when it comes to resolving conflict in marriage? Michael, in your writing and speaking, you bring up wrestling and physical discipline.
Sure.
What's the connection between physical fitness and spiritual health? Any biblical stories or teachings that you use to remind yourself to keep you going and push yourself when you're tired?
Well, sure. Your body reflects your lifestyle, obviously, right? So I've traveled, this is like my 30th trip, I think, this year. And a lot of times, I think learning to discipline yourself. I mean, where your discipline is your appetites. Your discipline where you spend your time. A lot of times the reason we're out of shape is we're not getting enough sleep. because we don't know how to walk away. We have to create order in our life. So it's kind of a feedback loop, really, that inner order and outer order, they feed each other after a while. You develop that. So it's, God made us this spirit-body composite, and when you work on your body and you work on your growing in virtue, those things feed each other. So, and there's this order, you know, in your, like, for example, think of it this way. If there's, I don't need to really interview elders. I'll just interview their wife and children. And I know who the man is. I'm not saying that kind of in jest, right? But they reflect what's going on. A lot of times the reason people are eating too much, drinking too much, or not exercising, whatever, is a manifestation of their anxiety, the lack of coming to God, and prayer. And so all those things, that they come together. Also, many of them know that they can, what I love about getting ordained in a really strict denomination is, I always tell people the next day, you should urinate blood after your ordination.
Right.
It should be that intense, okay? But it's a rite of passage. Like, you know you can do it. You know you can go hard. And a lot of times life isn't like that. There are moments where you pull all nighters for a reason. There's times where you have to maintain incredible focus because of the conflict you're in. So picking anything, anything that's challenging. It can be weightlifting, it can be wrestling, it can be tennis. You know, tennis is a frustrating hard sport. But learning to push yourself to find your limits, to test your limits, is a good for men. It's good for both men and women, but especially for men, because there's times we're called upon to go, things really hard. And you get bad session meetings, right? Where it's like 5 or 6 hours because there's something that's crazy going on in your church, and you can't leave until it's done. So you better be able to, you know, hold your focus and attention. So all those things play out. We create weird dichotomies and dilemmas that just aren't real. You know?
I'm trying to understand how the lightning round is different than what we were doing before.
Yeah. Okay, so
next question.
So much of what we've heard Friday night and this morning is countercultural, even in Christian circles today. So how should young men and women convey these concepts to friends and live in the world, in particular the Christian world, that they live in?
Of seven installments. Next question.
No, I don't know. Just do it. I mean, just live it out. I think that this, you know, living out masculinity for men or femininity for women, doing this, getting married and living in marriage this way is its own best defense.
Solve the life. That's what it is.
Okay, so you talk about working hard. In terms of making money, what's the balance between working overtime, being consumed by work and money, balancing that with risking family security and making sure you maintain that headship role in your family?
I don't know what the answer to this question right now. I can't say it's balanced in my life at this moment.
Well, yeah, and maybe seasons of life, yeah. Maybe seasons of life that you go through where you're not going to have the so-called work-life balance that people work for, one. And so long as you understand those sacrifices are for you know, the long-term good and not a permanent thing, you know, they're just taking away from, say, family life too much.
All right, I got one more thing. Real quick. When you're with your family, be with them. That's number one. And give them your full attention, put the phone away, and you can pull some long hours if everyone understands why you're doing it. And then when you're with them, that's exactly what you're doing. Right. They should feel like when you're at home that there's no other place you'd rather be. So when they know that you leave, you only do it because you need to.
Good, thank you. So with that, we're going to end our Q&A. We have one more hymn we're going to sing, and then Pastor Craw is going to come and close us in prayer. But first, give a round of applause for the speaker.